number of animals, how many acres. All of this is very, very site specific.
Unfortunately, federal support for soil conservation has eroded over the years.
There's limited technical service available. We've gutted our on-the-ground service providers. We have essentially pulled the rug out from under the structures that would, in fact, support this work on the ground.
The more we learned about carbon markets, the more we began to think they're no substitute for broad systemic solutions, which, as Alden says, remove rewards for doing the wrong things and replace them with support to do the right thing.
I don't think Big Ag is going to just sit around and let their subsidies be redirected to regenerative farmers.
That's why you need to come back for part two about breaking up Big Ag and an agricultural Green New Deal. You've been listening to Cool Solutions. Thanks to our guests, Chris Pravat, Jeff Creek, Alden Connolly, Ed Smith, Jim Goodman, and Stephen Woods. And to Scott Holmes, Josh Woodward, Dan Leibowitz, and Nat Keefe and the Bowties for our music.
It's 10:30 in the morning, which means it's time for Film at 11 on KBOO Community Radio. Hello, everybody. This is DK Home. Today we will talk about some documentaries, a few notable films, and a popular classic or two. So first, let's hear from Jeff Godsell of Essentials of Cinema.
A few minutes into Terry Zwigoff's Ghost World from 2001, and you can see that this is not a movie that's going to try too hard to win you over. I tend to like that. Movies like this tend to win me over. Especially if they feature characters like Enid and Rebecca, two newly graduated high school friends whose sardonic and cutting humor alienates them from just about everybody but themselves. These are two girls who I definitely would have wanted to hang out with in high school. Based on Daniel Clowes' graphic novel and co-written by Clowes and director Zwigoff, Ghost World follows Enid and Rebecca, played by American Beauty's Thora Birch and 16-year-old Scarlett Johansson in her first major role, beginning with their graduation and the days that follow. Like modern-day Holden Caulfields, they survey and comment on the shallowness and vapidity of their unnamed suburban town. For Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye, he was surrounded by phonies. For Enid and Rebecca, they're all just
jerks.
And it's hard to blame them when Zwigoff creates such a stinging and unfortunately familiar portrait of suburban life. The girls' barbs are not spared on each other either, which gives them a rather endearing quality. They are clearly best friends and most likely their only friends, which is fine by them. Rebecca favors rather plain, non-trendy, I-don't-care clothes, while Enid shapeshifts with a new look and different hair almost daily. Creativity is never lacking with the girls as they find new ways to stave off the boredom of their perceived entrapment. Entertainment can come in the form of torturing others. Like answering a lovelorn request in the back pages of the weekly magazine for a rendezvous. The girls set up the meeting in a cafe so they can sit and watch the poor victim, named Seymour, played by Steve Buscemi, sip his milkshake and wait for no one to arrive. A chance second meeting with the poor sap at a garage sale finds Enid surprisingly intrigued by the records that he's selling there. Eventually, something like a relationship actually develops between Enid and Seymour, much to Rebecca's chagrin. Meanwhile, the realities of life after high school begin encroaching on the girls. Rebecca succumbing to a job at a coffee shop, and Enid utterly unable to keep even the easiest of jobs, like at the concession stand at a movie theater in a particularly hilarious scene. Zwigoff never goes for big yucks in Ghost World, but gets them anyway if you're in the right frame of mind. Enid has to take a summer art class, a makeup class, so that she can actually graduate. The teacher, an earnest, artsy, self-proclaimed performance artist, is delightfully played by Ileana Douglas, Melvin Douglas's granddaughter and Martin Scorsese's ex-girlfriend, among other things. She's also the woman who gets her face chewed off by Robert De Niro in Cape Fear. I highly recommend her memoir, I Blame Dennis Hopper, an account of growing up weird in the fringes of Hollywood. Kind of like Running with Scissors, but with lots of film references. Zweigoff keeps Ghost World running at a very easy, lived-in pace, almost belying the momentous events that are about to occur in the girls' lives. Nothing less than the future is facing them, and Enid has a particularly rough time. After a couple of days where nothing seems to go right, she makes some hard choices, and Ghost World ends in a particularly touching and enigmatic way. For a teen coming-of-age movie, Ghost World is a kind of anti-John Hughes movie, darker in its humor and way cooler. Everyone fits in their roles like a glove, and it's unimaginable that anyone other than Buscemi could be Seymour. As usual, Ghost World did less than stellar business on its release, but has steadily grown to become a favorite among legions. I recommend the Criterion Edition with great extras and two booklets, including a comic book by Klaus himself. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Now, here are some recent releases. I Am Greta on Hulu is a touching documentary about Greta Thunberg, the teenager whose lone one-day-a-week school strike for the environment in front of the Swedish parliament snowballed into a global movement. You get to know her a bit and see her parents, and it turns out that she has a mild form of autism, but has also suffered some terrible excoriation from the likes of course, Fox News, quoted in the film, where someone called her a mentally ill brat who should shut up. The film follows her on a tour of global governments that culminates in an historic speech at the United Nations. And throughout the film, she proves to be somebody who is incapable of not speaking her mind. But she is not a scold. She's still just a teenage girl, too. Of all the disasters that we worry might befall us, for example, a massive earthquake in the Pacific Northwest, or the current pandemic, or global warming in general, did it occur to you that global destruction from a comet or other debris in space might be in store for us? Talk about a sixth extinction. We've barely survived the first five. Now, Werner Herzog takes the viewer on another anthropologic scientific documentary tour.
Throughout history, meteorites have captivated human imagination.
And in Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds on Amazon, he and scientist Clive Oppenheimer, with whom he's collaborated twice before, track down places on the Earth that have experienced cataclysmic encounters with meteorites.
Our voyage took us to wherever large fireballs had plunged down to Earth.
It's a very special place for us. That's where we feel the presence of our ancestors.
They include a Hindu temple in India. They also visit Mecca, also Yucatan, Mexico, where a massive crater is hidden underneath the ocean and the land. Maui, Hawaii, where they investigate telescopes there, and in the Vatican. And an interesting character in Norway, a prominent jazz musician who's found micrometeorites and various other places, including Antarctica, where Oppenheimer actually finds a bit of a meteorite buried in the ice. He also chronicles how the impact events subsequently shaped local cultures. Well, Herzog is not here to reassure you, but at the same time, he and Oppenheimer do want the viewer to appreciate the beauty, majesty, and mystery of the galaxy.
Every element in our body was synthesized in other stars before it got here.
Meanwhile, the Criterion Collection has released a two-disc DVD set of Martin Scorsese's The Irishman. This tale about Jimmy Hoffa and the main aides around him seems much better on second viewing, once freed of its need to be a Martin Scorsese film as it explores the consequences of a life lived on the dark side of American society, similarly to Raging Bull. Hence, the obit announcements when new characters are introduced, and the sense of death and strive for reconciliation that hang over other events even as they are happening. Which is why, ultimately, it doesn't matter that the film is based on a book whose accuracy or veracity has been questioned by some journalists. Tagged Criterion Collection Volume Number 1058, collect them all, the two-disc set comes with a newly edited roundtable conversation amongst the main cast members, a 90-minute making of, a new video essay by film critic Faron Smith Nemi, it's quite good, an anatomy of one scene from The Irishman, the Frank Sheeran Appreciation Night, I think this is one's from the New York Times, also excerpted interviews with the real Frank Sheeran, and also some news footage of Teamster Jimmy Hoffa. There's a trailer and teaser and an essay by the always dependable Jeffrey O'Brien. The only thing that the movie doesn't, that the DVD doesn't really go into is acknowledge that, you know what, the de-aging technology, it doesn't look so bad on the DVD, but it just doesn't work. And I finally figured out why. They couldn't change the shape of their heads or their faces. All they do is erase wrinkles and coloring from their actual faces as they exist today. When if you look back at Taxi Driver, for example, Robert De Niro has a much more, so to speak, petite face. But be that as it may, it is great to get together with the film again and these interesting, if despicable, characters. And now, here's Matthew on another treasure from popular culture.
Well, thanks, DK. Before I get started, I want to point out to our listeners that we're talking about a lot of movies that are available from the Criterion Collection. And right now, Barnes & Noble online is offering their Criterion discs for sale at 50% off until November 30th. So if you're interested in the movies we're talking about, this might be a good place to check out to see if they're still available. The first movie I've got to talk about is from 1964. It was the first movie by Japanese director Hideo Gosa. He'd been working in television and directing dramatic series. And in fact, this movie is an adaptation of the series that he was working on at the time. It stars Tetsuro Tonba, who a year later would appear in the James Bond movie You Only Live Twice as the head of the Japanese Secret Service. This is called Three Outlaw Samurai. It's the Edo period. A wandering ronin has stumbled across a mill that he wants to spend the night in, but inside, he finds a small group of farmers. They've kidnapped a woman, a high-class woman. In fact, she's the daughter of the local magistrate. They have a petition that they want to bring to him, but he's been ignoring them in spite of all the troubles they've gone through because of the taxes that he's been leveling on them during these years of drought. And so they figured that the only way to get his attention is to kidnap his daughter. The warrior kind of sees the problem with this, but he recognizes their commitment and that they're ready to die for their cause. And he kind of helps them out a little bit by, you know, pointing out that they keep an eye on the woman and don't let people sneak up on them. And he spends the night there. Of course, the magistrate sends his men over. And as the villains will do, they overplay their hand and they end up threatening the young warrior, and he kind of fights them off and sort of ends up joining the farmers. But he's kind of interested in rescuing the girl in a certain way. So, of course, the magistrate, we find out, is up to something no good, and he doesn't want the word of what he's been doing to get out, especially by the peasants. And so he starts hiring mercenaries to go, you know, get his daughter back and to kill this warrior. So the two other samurai who were the heroes together in the television series, this movie is sort of an origin story of how they met, Well, they're in this group that are sent over to get him. Shamba, you know, fights off the other mercenaries. The two other heroes, they sort of recognize his skill, but also recognize his honor and what he's doing. One quits the magistrate's man and joins him, and the third, you know, kind of hangs on to what he's doing. And so the whole story is kind of about how they all come together, how they try to save the peasants from what fate that they could have at the hands of these mercenaries and of the magistrate. Very wonderfully photographed, a stark black and white cinematography, use of light and darkness more in the way of positive and negative space. We look through grates in the wall and windows and plants. And the light just strikes part of the faces. It's a very stunning film, very nicely edited. You easily pick up on the confrontation between the two sides. And so that's Three Outlaw Samurai, very nicely put together film. The disc from Criterion really doesn't have any frills with it outside of a very nice booklet. But the movie looks really great. And it, by itself, it's just a wonderful experience. And so that's Three Outlaw Samurai from 1964. Now, of course, these Japanese sword movies had a big influence on the Hong Kong films. Their sword movies were a little bit more too much of their old opera style. People would pose and they'd wave swords around, and it just didn't look as exciting as you would like it to be, at least the way we do look at movies now. And because the movies we look at now are affected by the second movie I want to talk about, which is from 1967, made in Taiwan by one of the great directors of all time. And this movie was very popular in its day, became a big cult classic. Unfortunately, it had been unavailable for many years, partly due to two remakes that have been done, and I believe a TV series at one point. And I am, of course, talking about the great movie by King Hu, the original Dragon Inn. The time of the Ming Dynasty, 15th century. The evil eunuchs have taken over the government, and the magistrates are executing a patriotic general and has exiled his family out to the Western territories. But not being honorable men, they decide that it'd be best if this whole family was murdered. And so they send the secret police, the commander of the secret police, out to Dragon Inn, disguised as regular travelers, where they'll wait for the prisoners to show up, and then they'll just slaughter everybody. But while they're waiting, three other travelers show up, just looking like regular travelers, but these are actual soldiers who've been sent to rescue the family of this executed general. And so for a while, there's a little cat and mouse in the inn where they're, you know, they're trying to pretending to be innocent, but really there's stuff going on underneath, very nicely building up the tension. Some wonderful fight sequences that Hu was a pioneer in staging, and that has influenced all sorts of action films today, from Chinese Ghost Story and the Jackie Chan films and The Matrix and all these other things. The influence comes right from this movie from 1967. Hu was also big on Chinese history and culture, and so the detailing of the inn is just phenomenal. There's all sorts of great props that are all over the place. The costuming is interesting. He also utilized Western editing in a way that had not been done before, as well as the importing the Japanese swordplay. And his use of music was different from the time. Most Chinese films didn't really care about the music. They just dropped it in where they felt like it. But Hu was very specific, and he uses that sort of Chinese opera technique of always having the big characters make a big entrance into the film. And from his knowledge of the traditional Chinese opera, he's able to use that in a way that was totally unique. And then there'd be a sort of pose when characters were going to fight. But then they would do this Japanese fighting style, which just made a much more exciting film. At the time of its release, Hong Kong was in turmoil. The British-controlled police were putting down striking union workers in the streets, and so there was strife, and the city was on fire, practically. And this movie comes out where this group of heroes are fighting a corrupt government, really touched a lot of people at that time, and this movie just became really popular. Who would go on to do other films, but this was, and some considered his actual masterpieces, but as I said, this one's been unavailable for a very long time. The Criterion disc, which came out in 2018, has a lot of extras. It interviews the woman and the actor, who were two of the warriors who fight the evil secret police in this. And they are reminiscing working with King Hu, and what a great director he was. And there's also a breakdown of how he would stage his shots and everything. And so this is Dragon Inn from 1967, a really marvelous print. You can find it on YouTube if you look around. There's a copy of it at some of the Multnomah County Library branches, but they're not available for holds. You have to go to the branch to pick them up. So it's kind of unavailable from that source right now. But like I said, you can find some streamings from YouTube, or you can get the disc, as what we were talking about earlier. And so that's Dragon Inn and Three Outlaw Samurai. And that's my choices for today's show. So let's get back to DK.
Thank you, Matthew. Do you know where the word paparazzi comes from? I had forgotten until rewatching La Dolce Vita, wherein there is a character who works for a gossipy newspaper, capturing candid shots of celebrities, whose name is Paparazzo. The movie also has a weird callback to Rear Window, of all things. In the Hitchcock film, the only non-courtyard shot comes when a chopper hovers over a sunbather on the roof of the courtyard. But in La Dolce Vita, Marcello Mastroianni and the character named Paparazzo are in a helicopter following another one hauling a statue of Jesus across Rome. When they pause and turn around, when they spot four roof sunbathers. It's a funny moment that, in fact, encapsulates the moral quandary of the whole film. As the louche journalist and his photographer are easily distracted from their primary mission, from following God even, and by the immediate sensual pleasures often offered by Rome in abundance. La Dolce Vita also highlighted the fad of wearing sunglasses inside, of the interest in the jet set, of celebrity culture, and even Euro trash. And we're surprised by the sudden appearance of an aristocrat named Nico, who eventually ended up in the Velvet Underground. And in fact, it turns out that Pier Paolo Pasolini contributed to the script and also helped with a certain regional accent. Well, I learned of all of this and I'm reminded of these things in the second edition of the British Film Institute book on La Dolce Vita by Richard Dyer, now in its second edition, though with no new material. Near the end of the book, he summarizes the film's fascinating contradictions. Quote, "The combination of sparingly but judiciously used camera movement, dissolves and sharp cuts, with a depthless but lucid image, and bright, unobtrusive music, with dialogue trimmed of portentousness, not only saves La Dolce Vita from being boring, heavy, bleak, and dreary, but also embodies the complexity of the film's perception of the sweet life. It is aware of the critique to be made and the near desperation of the characters, but it also responds to the allure, the chic and fun of this world. It achieves a distance, but never a superiority, a perspective, but not a detachment. This is also how it managed to be a huge success and a great divider of opinion. End quote. Richard Dyer professed film at the University of Warwick and is a longtime author of such works as Stars and a volume about composer Nino Rota, as well as two other books in the BFI series on Brief Encounter and Seven. This book follows the template, beginning with a personal account, then a fascinating section on the milieu from which the story sprang, and a list of precursor Rome films made at the time, before La Dolce Vita, followed by a making-of chapter, how the film works in terms of pace, camera, and music, and its still ongoing legacy, which, by the way, includes Portland writer Sean Levy and his recent book, Dolce Vita Confidential. The book begins and ends with the film's personal effects on Richard Dyer, and the first one is worth quoting at length, describing his sneaking in to see the movie at the Curzon Theater in 1961 while he was underage and had to travel a long distance. Quote, "It is curious to me now that I was so intoxicated. I may have divined that there would be gay men, queers, in the film from press coverage, and not least that in the crypto-gay magazine Films and Filming, which featured the film on its January 1961 cover. Although they take up probably about 4 minutes on a nearly 180-minute film, it was and is commonplace to mention homosexuals as among the characteristic features of the film. Only 10 years later, in the flush of gay liberation, the representation of queers in La Dolce Vita would become officially for me a bad object, to be held up as an example of the insults even arthouse movies could throw at us. Yet I'm sure I never felt that in 1961. Perhaps it was enough that we queers were there in the film at all, and I accepted the effeminacy of the portrayal as indeed how I was supposed, and often did, behave. Perhaps, too, I did take in the fact that Marcello accepts the Queenie Pierino so straightforwardly, and that at the Fregene party, Pierino dances so delightedly with an unnamed shirtless hunk, at the latter's suggestion. It is, however, only very recently that I have noted just how much we are there, the character of Pierino cropping up far more often than I remembered throughout the film to comment on what is going on, and one of the transvestites, Maruccio, having the last words of the film, words developed even more in the shooting script. Queers, though marginal in terms of screen time or narrative importance, now seem to me central to the film in ways I discuss below. Moreover, not only was the queer's dialogue researched by Fellini's assistant Paolo Nuzzi, and Piero Paolo Pasolini was also on hand, but Pierino and Maruccio were played by queers who were celebrities within the narrow confines of Roman nightlife. And the roll neck top, still known as a Dolce Vita in fashion parlance, is worn by Pierino, not Marcello, in the film. The sense of these characters having weight in the film is not just film studies, queer theory, ingenuity. Yet even if I did not pick up on these elements of gay representation at the time, I am also not so surprised I was intoxicated by the film, for what is most striking about La Dolce Vita is its infectious brio, its verve and lightness of touch, its visual stylishness, its musical wit, and vivid performances. Not everyone experiences the film like that. For some, the listlessness, the boredom, nastiness, and despair of the subject matter went out over the bounce and grace of the treatment. But surely, it must be the latter qualities that have maintained its presence in the repertory in every successive reproductive format and as an endless point of reference." End quote. Finally, on this most recent reviewing, I noticed how much water proved to be important to the story. from the flooded streetwalker's apartment to the famous Trevi Fountain, and the scenes especially such as the final one at the beach. Motifs hold a film story together, and once noticed, they illuminate that story. Finally, avid listeners may recall that I called Millie Bobby Brown's English accent in Enola Holmes as magnificent. Turns out that she is English, so we are back to square one in finding U.S. performers who can achieve a convincing English accent. With that mea culpa, that's it for Film 11. We'll be back next week with more movies here on KBOO Community Radio, Portland. And until then, please keep watching the screens.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
In Pacific Expression.